Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here and presenting on behalf of the GRADE Consortium. So we're implementing this project in partnership with Save the Children and Pathfinder International with funding from USAID. So I have nothing to disclose. And when I was doing this slide, I was writing no conflicts. I have no conflicts. The presentation is about conflict, but it's not about disclosure. So then I went back and saw what I was actually supposed to write here. So GRADE, as we mentioned, it's about gender roles and equality transformation. And the purpose of this project really is to develop a scalable intervention to address gender norms that are supportive and end up in supporting sexual and reproductive health and decreasing gender-based violence, which, of course, is a big problem all around the world and especially in post-conflict areas. What I'm going to present today is the formative research or the ethnographic phase of the project, which took the first year of a five-year project. And we're using those research results right now to develop and test the interventions that we'll be rolling out in Uganda. We've actually already started rolling them out the last few months. So what we really wanted to understand with this research are the processes by which gender norms are formed, by which young people are socialized into different, you know, social norms and attitudes that have direct relationship with reproductive health. So the study design was ethnographic participatory research. We conducted 40 life histories with young people in these four life courses. So we did 10 life histories, very young adolescents, 10 to 14-year-old. Then we moved on to older adolescents, newly married, and newly pregnant or parenting boys and girls. And then we also identified 40 in-depth interviews with people that the youth identified as significant in their lives. So each one of them identified people who were significant in their process of becoming men and women and growing up. We did this in two post-conflict districts in northern Uganda, one Lango cultural area and another the Acholi area. The research was very participatory. We used a lot of projective techniques to really try to delve into some of these gender norms. Here you can see spider mapping. We also used these animals where people would choose, you know, what's an ideal man, and they would choose a lion or a cow or whatever. And so we were able to talk about gender in more nuanced ways than is sometimes possible. So as I'm sure all of you know, that northern Uganda has gone through a very difficult 20 years of civil strife with 2 million people displaced, you know, a lot of disruption, a lot of really negative consequences. But the good news is that it has been peaceful since 2006. Just recently before this project started, the IDP camps were closed, and all of the deep displaced people that we're working with were returned to their ancestral homes or their villages. So we're working with recently returned populations, but there's still a lot of challenges. So there's a lot of disruption in traditions, there's a lot of economic insecurity, and a lot of aftermath from the conflict, especially facing the young people who grew up in a very difficult situation in these camps. So why gender norms? So there is, of course, a lot of challenges in this setting. So why, with all the things that are facing these families who have returned to their homes, are we focusing on gender norms? So we really understand that evidence shows us that gender norms, which are the social expectations of how men and women should behave in different roles, have really significant influences on all of these health outcomes. So we feel like to really bring about sustainable, lasting change, we need to start there with gender norms and roles, and we also need to start young, which is why this project is starting, including 10 to 14-year-olds, which is a little bit unusual for my field, which is population and family planning. So gender norms and conflict. So there's a lot of research that suggests that armed conflict and its aftermath can significantly impact gender roles and expectations and really aggravates already existing gender inequalities. So the hypothesis is that the inability among men to live up to their traditional masculine roles causes, as a protector and a provider, causes a lot of frustration for them, and it really aggravates some of these other areas in their lives where they try to overemphasize perhaps other parts of masculinity by showing control over men, over women and children. So that's really kind of the theoretical basis that, you know, we're working with here. So some of the things that happened in the life in the IDP camps that were particularly important in this area, you know, men were much more women were became much more involved in supporting their families. They lived on food aid, which were given out to women, not to men. It was difficult for men to continue the normal agricultural activities. It wasn't safe for them to do so. They didn't have the land. Family structure was disturbed. They really started living in one hut or one house, that they would call it, rather than in more spread out areas where young people used to go live in their own huts under their grandparents' control, where they were taught and nurtured. So there was a lot of alcohol use, a lot of violence in the camps, and of course children grew up seeing a lot of sex, a lot of forced sex, and a lot of violence. And they also began to form unions in ways that weren't culturally sanctioned. So they didn't have some of the support that they might have had as a new couple, you know, in a less conflictive area. So the gender-related challenges continue. There's a lot of marital conflict. There's very widespread levels of gender-based violence, some of the highest in the country, and of course a lot of alcohol use as well. So men and women recognize this. They themselves are talking about this. They feel that the situations in the camp resulted in some of the conflicts that they're facing now. So a woman commented, as the war began to calm down, the men had become very used to situations in the camp, and they found it difficult to dig or do other work. They also talked a lot about alcohol. So one man said, this war created a gap between men and women. Men would go and struggle to get something to eat just for themselves and not even for the family. Very few men cared for their families, but the women struggled to get firewood and bring food to their children. So to some extent, women learned that women can do a lot more than they, and they have withdrawn from their responsibilities. They've left all of the garden work for the women. And then it goes on, it says, women are now doing a lot of other things like paying school fees, buying clothes, taking their children to the hospital. So you're starting to see some of those gender changes. So moving more into the field of family planning, which is the area that we're particularly working with. So how does gender influence family planning use? So really there's three areas. There's a desire for children, there's distrust of contraception, and there's male power over women. So in terms of the desire for children, it's a way for both men and women to demonstrate their masculinity and femininity in a very unstable and uncertain time. In addition, women's value in this setting really derives from her economic contribution. It comes from the dowry, the bride price, and also from the labor that the children bring into the family. Men are very concerned, and women, but especially men, about contraception because they fear that it will affect their fertility. And then, of course, control over women. So I'm moving into a few quotes to illustrate some of those things. This is an example of how it affects women. So when the girls were asked, you know, what's your greatest hope for the future? And she says, you know, giving birth is the most important. In this world, if you don't have a child, your life is worthless and people will insult you. You know, men also, you know, feel that if they don't have children, they're not going to be respected as full community members. So a man says, now that I have a child, when I'm among people, I'm seen as mature. I can sit among the clan. If there are no children in your family, people will minimize you and no one will come to visit your home. So you see some of the importance of, you know, gender norms. Children are very highly valued, you know, in all settings, but especially in this post-conflict setting. They see large families, more children, as a continuation of the lineage. It's support, you know, in an unstable time, more people give you safety in the numbers around you. They want legitimized unions, they bring joy to the family, and they, of course, make a significant, you know, contribution. Men's power over women, which, as I mentioned, can be very aggravated in these settings, is really important in that women don't have access to the resources they need to use, in this case family planning. They don't have access to the resources, the transportation to do so, and they can't really do it easily without their husband's permission. So the threat of their husband's disapproval and violence is a very chilling factor for them. So what is unique, you know, all of these things I just talked about could be said about really a lot of different settings. So what's unique about gender and family planning in a post-conflict setting? So as I mentioned here before, men really feel the need to demonstrate their masculinity in areas such as health, where they do have some control. And there's two conflicting forces here. On one hand, families really are desiring a larger family for the reasons I just mentioned. But on the other hand, you know, economic times are changing, there's land disputes, there's a lot of difficulty of supporting families. So there's a push for a smaller family. So those are really two conflicting areas then, of course, a lot of changing values around sex from because of what the children and the families have seen. Violence and alcohol use are also really important factors in the environment influencing this. So, of course, people do challenge these traditional gender norms, but at a great cost to themselves sometimes. So women face psychological or physical abuse. Men are pressured to divorce if they're not producing. You know, everyone in this scenario is losing respect and status. So if a man says, for us in Acholi, if you bring a wife and she's there for 2 years and has no child, she will be chased away. There'll be a lot of talk about her. The elders' eyes will be on you. So if they wait in vain, my brother, there will be many problems. You may want to go on a journey and your wife says she has to go with you because if she stays behind, she'll be treated badly. The people in your home begin hating each other for things that you don't even understand. So, you know, this is interesting information, and then what are we going to do with it? I think is really important. So what we found are opportunities. There's a situation here where people really want to rebuild their culture. They are back in their communities. They have a lot of hope. They have a lot of energy towards the future. So the idea is that this desire to recover from the conflict and revitalize cultural traditions can be leveraged into new opportunities and interventions. So we're working on building on positive cultural norms that were found during the research, such as a lot of value in respect for others, a value of healthy timing and spacing of pregnancies, and then also building on some of the nurturing, protective elements of gender to build those into the intervention. So the model that we're working on is driven by a serial radio drama, which is called Oteka, which also means great. So really the whole project is wrapped around being a great man, being a great woman, being a great mentor, you know, all of that really neatly kind of pulled it in. So we have the radio drama. We have community mobilization because it's very important to involve the cultural leaders. There have been a lot of work on gender in northern Uganda that's been rejected because people see it as coming from the outside and very imposed on them. So really, we're working with different cultural leaders. Then we also have an enabling environment where we're working to strengthen the service linkages. And all of this in the middle is what we're calling a scalable toolkit. So we've developed a set of materials that existing platforms in the communities, youth clubs, savings and loans groups, religious organizations, can use to catalyze discussion around some of these issues. And the scalable toolkit consists of about, you know, different tools that are tailored for the life course. So we have radio discussion guides so that the groups can come together and discuss the radio. We have some activities that we have a puberty book, coming of age flip book that we use with the younger kids. Then we have a set of activity cards where people can, this is an example of one of them. So for the younger age group, there's a relay race where boys and girls line up and they practice washing dishes. So the idea is, can boys and girls wash dishes better? It sounds sort of silly, but they love it, and then they do it, and then there's questions about, well, you know, why can't boys help girls more with the chores? Why is it the girls who are doing all the chores, which has very serious implications in terms of going to school and doing their homework? Then there's also a community game, which has a big board that's laid out on the ground, and all the families and people come together and ask questions and do activities to, again, really catalyze kind of a broader conversation in the community. So that is some of the toolkit, and they are just starting to roll out all of these activities really this month. So thank you, and if you have clarifying questions, I'm happy to answer.